Yesterday, I drew a picture on the board, describing some scattering process of strings. As a certain number of strings coming in and some coming out, and some smooth wash sheet. Interpolating between the configuration in the past and the one in the future. So this worksheet, let me give it a name, Sigma. So describes the evolution of this string in space-time. In the same sense as a picture like this, will describe schematically a perturbative process in quantum field theory. Except in quantum field theory, I get some graph gamma that describes the way the world lines interact. And in quantum field theory, you know how to compute the contribution of a given from a diagram to your scattering amplitude by using some simple rules. Similarly, I want to teach you today, at least in principle, how would you compute the contribution to the scattering amplitude due to this surface sigma. So I'm going to do so in the so-called bosonic string theory. Now, the final formula looks at first very strange. It's a combination of two integrals. There is a path integral on the space of all maps from sigma into space-time. With some action. The action depends on this map and on some extra data, which we'll have to specify. Somehow encode some intrinsic geometry of this Riemann surface, of this surface, sorry. And then we also need some integral over these extra structures, which is a finite dimensional integral. Now, in order to motivate this expression, I want to just write a completely analogous expression for quantum field theory. So I'm going to show you that in a scalar quantum field theory, you can rewrite your standard Feynman diagram amplitude as an integral, as two integrals, a path integral over maps from gamma from the graph into the space-time with some simple action. And then a finite dimensional integral over certain parameters, which in a sense are lengths of these world lines. Okay. This is going to be a sort of the action for a relativistic particle. It's going to be an action for a string.
Mm-hmm. Aren't the lengths already specified once you've mapped the graph into Euclidean space or Minkowski space?
Well, I never said these are the lengths that you find from the embedding. Okay. So I'm going to write an action for a particle which depends both on this map and on some specification of lengths. I'm doing the path integral, and then I integrate over the lengths. This is sort of a first quantized description of the process.
But, so for example, if you just this on a free particle.
Mm-hmm.
What? How would you put this L in?
I'm going to show you in a moment.
Okay.
I'm just, for now, I'm just saying there is a way to rewrite the Feynman amplitude this way. And then this will be completely analogous. So let me consider a theory of scalars, just one scalar field with some mass m. How does the Feynman integral look like? Let me put some labels. Let me denote the interaction points as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There will be internal momenta, say P12, P23, P34, P45, P51. I can also sort of also have some external momenta. I could just label the external legs by other numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and call this external momenta P55 prime, P44 prime, P33 prime, etc. Okay. Then schematically, if I'm integral is an integral over the internal momenta. Of a bunch of delta functions for the vertices. And propagators. I should probably also put an I epsilon. But anyway, doesn't matter. Okay. So anybody has objections to this expression?
Why are there no weights related to the internal vertices?
Sorry?
Just momentum conservation and no coupling constant?
I can put the G to the number of vertices.
Okay.
But let me just ignore that. Okay, so the first step in my manipulation is going to be to take the propagators and rewrite them in a proper time formalism. I can also take the delta functions. And rewrite them as integrals over spacetime. Of integrals over the positions of the interaction points. I'm ignoring also the factors of 2 pi, 2 pi is 1. So, are you okay with these ones too? Right. So after I do this, the integrals of the moment are Gaussian, and I can just execute them. So now I have a product over internal vertices of the integrals over the positions of these internal vertices. the wave functions for the external particle. And then some propagators in position space. So I've got rid of the integrals for the momenta, I'm left with the integrals for the positions, and the integral over this length. So you can, as you will see, you can think about this as sort of the proper time length of these internal legs. Okay. Now we are almost where we want to be. For now, we just have an integral over these lengths, an integral over the positions to the vertices. Now I want to write this part as a path integral over the positions of each individual point of the edges. So I need to find an interesting expression for this Green's function, for the position space propagator. So let me just give it a name. So to understand the meaning of this expression, let's just write down the action for a relativistic particle. Anybody remembers the action for a relativistic particle? So if I have a particle which has some trajectory in space-time, what's the action? Yes. So, which can be written as, so let's introduce some parameter which parametrizes the trajectory. Let me run it from 0 to 1, it's purely conventional. And then I have something like square root of dx mu over du, dx mu over du. Okay. So I describe my trajectory as some map, right, from the interval to space-time. Now, this action, the choice of this parametrization is completely arbitrary. You can see it from the fact that this action has a gauge invariance. If you just redefine u as some function of u prime, this action does not change because the derivative with respect to u gets a Jacobian squared, take the square root, and it cancels this. So if I want to try to define a path integral, if I want to quantize this action, say, path integral over all trajectories which starts from some point in space-time and then on some other point in space-time. I need to divide away this gauge symmetry, otherwise I'll overcount trajectories a lot. So these sort of transformations are diffeomorphisms of your word line. I'll denote it as diff, the group of diffeomorphisms. So I need to do a path integral of all trajectories modulo diffeomorphism of this action. Okay. Now, this path integral is hard to do because the action is not polynomial. It's not a nice Gaussian action, right? I have a square root of a of something.
I didn't understand this diffeomorphism here in the integral. What was this?
So what are the gauge symmetries of these actions? Are maps from the segment into the segment. These are called diffeomorphisms. So the gauge symmetry of this action is the group of diffeomorphisms of the segment. So when I do my path integral, I don't want to overcount. Right? If I really want to do a path integral over the actual trajectory in space-time, forgetting about the parametrization, I need to divide out by this symmetry. And of course, to do that properly requires perhaps a little bit of work, like gauge fixing, BRST quantization, whatever. It will actually be, turn out to be quite easy to gauge fix, so we don't need to use BRST formalism here. But the main problem is that this action is not polynomial. Just write that x dot squared. So what I want to do is to replace this classical action by some other classical action which is equivalent to it, and then try to, but could be quantized more easily. So the trick is to introduce a new degree of freedom. Let me call it E of u. And write the following action. This action is still diffeomorphism invariant as long as this E behaves properly, meaning I want E du, E of u du, to be the same as E of u prime, the u prime, right? So under diffeomorphisms, x of u goes to some x of f of u, e of u goes to e of f of u, df over du. These are our gauge transformations now. And it's easy to show that this action is invariant under these gauge transformations. Now, this action is quadratic in x. That's good. Of course, it's still not polynomial in e. We cannot just get rid of the problem completely. But the nice thing is that we can gauge fix e away. See, if you look at this transformation, you see that if you want to get rid of E, pretty much all you need to do is to pick an F such that the df of du is 1 over E. Right? I have sort of 1 degree of freedom in E, 1 degree of freedom in my gauge transformations. I can get rid of most of E. But not, I cannot quite get rid of all of E in the sense that the integral of E from 0 to 1 is gauge invariant. Is the, let me call it L. So it's easy to show that you can always pick a diffeomorphism that allows you to get rid of E almost completely, except for this constant mode. So you can always gauge fix E to be constant and equal to 1 over L. Any questions about that? So after you do that, E is gone. Just have L, right? And your gauge fixed action is now very simple. E and L are identical, right? I'm sorry. Let me just write it capital L for now. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So just to clarify, you're saying that this action is equivalent to one we started with once.
Classically, That's right. Classically, this actually is equivalent to that. You just integrate away e. Mm-hmm. The equation tells you that e squared is x dot squared. So e is square root of x dot. You plug it in, you get that. On the other hand, once I get fixed, I get an action which is quadratic in x. And it still depends on this parameter, but this is not a function of u anymore. It's just a constant. So I end up essentially replacing this integral with an integral in dl. Followed by a path integral with this simple quadratic action. Right? So essentially, I went from this to some integral over dx dE over diffeomorphisms of e to the minus f action of as a function of x and e, and then I gauge fixed. So this replacement is more like a definition. I just didn't know how to make sense of this. I replaced it with this. And then I gauge fixed. Now, this is something you should recognize from your quantum mechanics course, right? A path integral with an action which is x dot squared, you know what the answer is. It's precisely that. So this factor is the same as a path integral over all trajectories which starts at x0, xa, and end at xb. With that action. So it's this. Any questions? So which means that this whole thing now can be written as an integral over these lengths together with an integral over all ways to map the vertices to points of space-time and the edges to points of to trajectories in space-time. Mm-hmm.
Having a big L is I mean, that's a positive, right?
Sorry?
You've written the integral over big L as from 0 to infinity.
Yes.
So why not minus infinity to infinity?
That's true. I was a little bit not too careful here. We want E pretty much to be positive, but go to the, this is a good answer for that. The point is that there are two, there is a second sort of, there is a risk of overcounting because when I have a trajectory in space-time, I decided that my parametrization was going from 0 to 1 in one direction, right? That was an arbitrary choice. I could have done it in the opposite way. So that would have meant changing the sign of u. So here, the diffeomorphisms I was gauging by were diffeomorphisms connected to the identity, which fixed the endpoints. There was a little bit of an extra freedom in sort of exchanging the two endpoints. And when I do that, L goes to minus L. So it's reasonable to integrate from 0 to infinity. Okay. So this justifies this expression. The Feynman diagram can be written as an integral over these lengths, which are sort of the gauge invariant part of the E's, and an integral over all the maps on the graph into spacetime. So I want to try to do the same now for the string. So the first step will be to understand what is the action for a string. So can you guess how to generalize the action of a particle to the action of a string? So a particle is one-dimensional word line in space-time, and you have an action which is the length of the word line. A string describes a two-dimensional word sheet to space-time. What could the action be? That's right. So I'm going to put some constant in front, which is analogous to the mass. And then I can parameterize the worksheet locally by some coordinates, U1 and U2. So in this picture, I will just sort of define coordinates of points by some parameter. So I'll just pick some local coordinates on the worksheet. Of course, I typically cannot pick local coordinates globally on the worksheet. We'll have to have patches. We'll discuss this later. But for now, in each patch, at least, I can pick a parametrization of the worksheet and write down an action, which is the area. What is the area? Well, it's the square root or the integral of the square root of the determinant of a 2x2 matrix, which is the pullback of the metric from space-time. Right? So I take my position of the worksheet as a function of U1 and U2. I compute the pullback of the metric, is a 2x2 matrix. I take the determinant. This gives me the unit area on the surface, and I integrate over the surface. Is this expression familiar to you? Now, this expression is, again, diffeomorphism invariant. I can change this choice of coordinate to any other choice of coordinate, mapping U1 to some function of U1 and U2, and U2 to some function of U1 and U2. Right. And these coordinate transformations are precisely what I need to join together different patches of my surface. So this integral makes sense as an integral of the whole surface. So actually, let me keep these variables capital to distinguish them from a particle. Okay. So I want to try to make sense of a path integral of the form integral over all the x's divided by diffeomorphisms of e to the minus s of x. But again, we have the problem that this is not quadratic, it's not polynomial, it's very hard to work with. No idea how to quantize something like that. So this is something called the Nambu-Goto action, by the way. So I want to find another action which is classically equivalent to this, that has some extra auxiliary degrees of freedom, which make the dependence on the axis a bit better. This is called the Polyakov action. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a new degree of freedom, which is a metric on the worksheet. And then I'm going to write a Polyakov action. Which is just the simplest thing you can write, pretty much. So it turns out that if you integrate away the metric in the Polyakov action, you go back to the number go-to action. The equations of motion of the metric fix it to be the pullback of the space-time metric. The metric induced from the embedding of your surface into space-time. Now, in order to proceed in analogy to with the particle case, we should now try to gauge fix the metric away using diffeomorphism symmetry. Because this action is quadratic in the X in the map, but is not quadratic in the metric. Remember, this is the determinant of the metric. And this is the inverse metric. So there is a problem though. A metric in two dimensions has three components. Diffeomorphisms have two components. So you just cannot use diffeomorphisms alone to make your metric trivial, say flat. And it is quite clear, two-dimensional metrics can have curvature. The curvature is a diffeomorphism invariant notion. So I clearly cannot get rid of curvature by a coordinate transformation. The best I can do using diffeomorphisms is to map my metric to be locally conformally flat. So I cannot make it flat, but I can make it proportional to the flat metric. So see, now I have only 1 degree of freedom. I had three, I used two diffeomorphisms and left it one. This can be done only locally. There are all sorts of interesting issues here, global issues, but we'll come back to that in a few minutes. Now, something very nice happens. If you take this action and you plug in a metric which is proportional to the flat metric, the result does not depend on the conformal factor, does not depend on phi. The way this happens is that this is a factor of e to minus phi, and this is a factor of e to the phi, and they cancel out. Now, this tells us that we were doing something, we were not really thinking about the problem in the correct way. So we were trying to study. So if you just went in analogy with the particle, we would have said, I want to study a path integral over X and over the metric over modding out the diffeomorphisms as a gauge symmetry. But it turns out that the action is actually independent of one extra degree of freedom. So this action is actually invariant under a different transformation. So this was diff. But there is another transformation, it's called while transformations. We just take the metric and rescale it. So this action happens to be invariant under Botti-Fermi morphisms in vial symmetry, which means that introducing a whole metric as an auxiliary degree of freedom was a bit of a silly thing, because metrics related by vial transformations would have the same action, would give the same action. Instead, what really should do is to integrate over the space of metrics modulo scale transformations. This is a better chance to be a good definition. Now, there is a little caveat here about the fact that even if the action is variant under wild transformations, the measure might not be. We'll come back to this at the very end of the lecture. But for now, it looks like this will be a more sensible definition. And once I have wild symmetry, I can really gauge fix the metric to be exactly flat. Right, I can just adjust my transformation lambda to get rid of phi. So now we can proceed, because we get fixed away the metric completely, and we are just left with a nice quadratic action in these fields. Now, even classically, something quite nice happened, right? I started with a very nonlinear problem, which is classically, what is the problem? It's finding surfaces of extreme, which extremize the area, like soap bubbles. It's a very nonlinear problem, but somehow you can manipulate it until it becomes a free problem. You know, just solving a bunch of Laplacians. Where is the trick? The trick is that when you gauge fix, you need to remember the constraints. The equations of motion of the metric are still something you need to impose. You only need to impose them as sort of as initial conditions, and they remain true during evolution, but they need to be imposed. So when we do gauge fixing properly, we'll see that. Even classically, you still need to impose that the variation of the metric respect to the action vanishes. So this remains as a constraint on your equations of motion. This is the same as the two-dimensional stress tensor. And it's just something like dx mu over dua, dx mu over dub, minus del dB. There is some correction. So it turns out that the problem of finding minimal surfaces in some space, in flat space, can be solved by looking at free action, so it's really looking at a bunch of Laplacian of x equal to zero, subject to this quadratic constraint. Doing this quantum mechanically will require more work. We'll have to use ghosts, DRST quantization, and so on. But this is the basic idea. This is what makes the problem really tractable, the fact that everything is, we're just using free fields.
Mm-hmm. Once you've already chosen the gauge fixed action,
yes,
I don't really understand how the constraint adds anything to the, like, it doesn't add any new information.
Classically, what happens? It means that if you look at the equations of motion for the gauge fixed action, mm-hmm. Not all of them are solutions of the original problem, but only the ones for which the initial conditions satisfy the constraint.
What do you mean by initial conditions?
It's like the. Well, the whole solution has to satisfy this constraint. But this constraint automatically holds as long as it's satisfied in the initial conditions. I mean, the equations of motion here are some equations of partial differential equations in U1 and U2, right? And you had to put some boundary conditions to solve them.
Yeah, but like that, to me, that action, I mean, this constraint just says that the action is independent of H, right?
It's the equations of motion for H.
So we have
a bunch of equations of motion, which depends on a certain set of degrees of freedom. We use our gauge freedom to set some of these degrees of freedoms to some convenient values. But the equations of motions are still there. They have a bit less content than the equations of motion for the non-gauge fixed modes, but they don't have trivial content. A good exercise for this is to look at the Coulomb gauge in electromagnetism. When you solve the equation of motion of electromagnetism, you get a constraint, right? Divergence of A has to vanish. Any more questions?
Is that a dot dot dot?
Sorry, I don't remember if it was 1/2 or 1/3 or what numerical factor, but then there was something like the x mu over the uc,
okay.
The x mu over the uc. I just don't remember if it's 1/2. I think it is. Okay, so Now I need to find the analog of the lengths. Which gauge invariant information did I forget when I said that I can get rid of the metric completely? It's a bit harder to answer this question because for example, you cannot use lengths in any way as a gauge invariant notion because while transformation change lengths. Intuitively, you preserve angles because scaling a flat metric preserves angles. So your coordinate, so your gauge invariant information must know something about the angles on your surface. But to do better, we need to really characterize which sort of gauge freedom have I left after I do this transformation? Which sort of information is left? So suppose I go back to this picture. Locally, I said there is no problem in solving the differential, in finding a diffeomorphism that sends H to be proportional to the flat metric, and then a wild transformation that makes it flat. So locally, I can surely say my metric is flat. Now what happens in, so I can just pick in each patch a coordinate system for which this is true. Now what happens when I go from a patch to the next? So I have my transformation. When I do this transformation, my flat metric is mapped to something that looks like this. And I want this to be proportional to the flat metric again. So I need to find all, I need to characterize what are the coordinate transformations which map a flat metric to a conformally flat metric. These are called conformal, well, conformal Killing vectors, infinitesimally, anyway. So I need to characterize these transformations. Now, in dimension higher than two, these transformations are pretty rare. But in two dimensions, it turns out that there are a lot of them. So a way to understand, a way to find a solution to this problem is to use complex coordinates. So define a coordinate z, which is u1 plus I u2. Then your flat metric looks like the z bar. Okay, there's a factor of 2i, but that's one. If I do a coordinate transformation, which is holomorphic, then the metric becomes this. But this is just a number, right? A real number, actually. So these transformations definitely leave a flat metric, map a flat metric to a conformally flat metric. And it turns out that this is all that there is, at least orientation preserving. So if you just replace your real coordinates with one, with your two real coordinates with one complex coordinate, then you discover that your coordinate transformations must be holomorphic. So by doing local gauge fixing and comparing your different local gauge fixing, you ended up covering your surface with an atlas of complex coordinates with complex coordinate transformations. This is what's called a complex structure. You're really looking at the surface now as a complex manifold of complex dimension one. The complex structure on the surface is a gauge invariant quantity. Is the gauge invariant quantity. Is what's telling us that the surface is not just a flat space. It's some sort of information that is left even after we gauge fixed as much as we could. Now, it turns out that the space of that a given surface can be endowed with complex structures in many different ways, but there is a finite dimensional space of complex structures. So, in conclusion, the analog of this integral over lengths here becomes an integral over the space of complex structures.
What is a complex structure again?
It's a way to equip your surface with complex coordinates.
And you need a continuous mapping and holomorphic transformation, something like any other constraint?
No, so every time you give me a surface and you equip it with complex with an atlas of complex coordinates, that's a complex structure. Okay. Now, obviously, just giving you this definition, it's far from obvious that there's a finite dimensional space of complex structures, for example. What you can do is that you can sort of ask yourself, how do I change a complex structure a little bit? You can sort of do, maybe change your definition in the non-holomorphic way infinitesimal in each patch, and then try to see if you can modify your coordinate transformations in a way that they're holomorphic in the new coordinates. You have sort of a certain amount of freedom in each patch, so change the definition of your holomorphic coordinate, and a certain amount of freedom in each intersection of patches, which is change the map within the patches. If you look at how the problem looks like, you end up with a problem in cohomology. So the change in the complex structure ends up being an element in the cohomology of the surface in some cohomology theory. And you can compute that cohomology theory and find it's a finite dimensional space. So you find that there's a finite number of ways to change the complex structure of a surface.
Possible complex structures on a surface continuously connected to each other?
Yes, and that's actually a very nice non-trivial fact. So this, so here I drew a sort of a topological picture. The only thing that really mattered was how many external tubes are there and how many sort of handles you have. So you could say I have a surface with n tubes and g handles. And there is a modelized space of such surfaces, which is a nice, actually complex manifold, connected. And I'm gonna say something more about it in a moment. But anyway, so this is what we need to do to compute a string theory scattering amplitude. We need to, at least the contribution of a given topology, so string theory scattering amplitudes. Yes?
So, sorry, just to clarify for myself. So basically, from what we did over here for this, is it just that the integral over this additional metric and module or the diffeomorphisms on Weyl all got replaced by this integral?
That's right. So I said, essentially I'm saying that this becomes a path integral over x and a finite dimensional integral over complex structures. Right, so to find this answer, we need to do two things. We need to learn how to do path integrals over fields that live on a two-dimensional surface with some funny topology. So this is a problem in two-dimensional conformal field theory, quantum field theory, actually. But these are free fields, so it's not a terribly hard problem. It's doable. It's a bit painful because the surface is complicated, but it's still free field theory. And then after I do the calculation for a given complex structure, I need to find a way to integrate over the space of complex structures to get the final answer. So in the next few lectures, so we spend a few lectures on how to do this, and then we'll describe how to do that. Now, how does this space of complex structures look like? Let me give some examples. What's the simplest possible scattering amplitude I can write? In quantum field theory, it would be something like one line comes in, line come out, go out. In string theory is one tube comes in and two tubes go out. So this is what you call, it's a surface that has three external legs and no extra handles. Now this has just one complex structure. There is no freedom in here, it turns out. This is completely analogous to the fact that here there were no internal lengths. Next example. Suppose I have a three-level four-point amplitude. I can draw three Feynman diagrams. Okay. And of course, right? The S channel, T channel, and U channel Feynman diagrams. On the other hand, there is just one topology of worksheet. Well, it's sigma 4, 0. So here in quantum field theory, we had one real degree of freedom, the internal length of this edge. So so we had three graphs, gamma S, gamma T, gamma U. And I can adapt their moduli spaces. So each of the moduli spaces look like a line parameterized by the length of the corresponding edge. And morally speaking, the three graphs meet together at the point where the lengths go to zero. So the moduli space kind of looks like this. Three real lines, three positive lines meeting at one point.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what's a moduli space?
I just mean the space of L's, the thing I was integrating over. So the space of L's, right, for this graph is just R plus, the positive real line. For this graph is just R plus, the positive real line. S, U, L, T. And just for fun, let me attach these three half lines together. Because morally speaking, when the lines go to zero, you just get this graph. Right. Now, let me try to describe for you the moduli space of complex structures of this surface. It turns out to be one complex dimensional space. And it roughly looks like this. Now, I'm sorry, don't confuse this with a worksheet. I'm not describing the worksheet. I'm describing the space of complex structures. So for each point on this space, describes some complex structure on this manifold. Roughly speaking, this complex structure corresponds to a surface which looks like this. This complex structure corresponds to a surface which looks like this. And this complex structure looks like the surface that looks like, well, now I will not do it very well. Sorry. Anyway, these are surfaces that are supposed to remind you of an S channel, T channel, and U channel Feynman diagram. So this is a pattern that repeats itself for general surfaces. Mm-hmm.
They are all diffeomorphic.
Yeah, they're the same. Topologically, they're the same, but they have a different complex structure. Now, you could ask, in which sense does a picture like this represent the complex structure? What I mean is that if you take this picture, you just put the metric that you see and you gauge fix it, you'll get the complex structure corresponding to this point or this point or this point. Right, the complex structure is a gauge fixed metric, So in particular, to give a complex structure, I can just give you a metric. There can be many different metrics which give you the same complex structure. But if I just needed to give you a description of the complex structure, I can just draw a picture. You sort of derive the metric from the picture, and you gauge fix it to a complex structure. So as you see, the modular space of surfaces for a string theory process, or complex structures for a string theory process, kind of looks like a complexified version of the modular space of lengths for the Feynman diagrams. Except it does not have some nasty point like this. It's nice and smooth. Well, it has some singularities, but nothing serious. So more generally, if you look at the modular space for a general surface, it's a very complicated space. But it has patches where the surface kind of looks like a Feynman diagram, somewhat thickened up. So those patches are sort of responsible for the fact that the string theory at low energy behaves like a quantum field theory, actually. But the fact that everything is nice and smooth is part of the reason that string theory has no UV divergences. Right? The UV divergence in a Feynman diagram corresponds to the situation where some of these interaction points collide, just sort of these sort of special points here in the space of lengths of Feynman parameters, proper lengths. But there is no such singular point here. OK, so I'm a little bit over time. Let me just use two more minutes. As I said, this is OK only while symmetry is actually symmetry of this action, of this measure, not just of the action. Now, when you have a symmetry of an action, the classical action, you try to quantize the classical action, the symmetry might or not survive quantization. It survives for sure if you can discretize your measure, regularize your measure in a way that preserves the symmetry. Then you're fine. But if you cannot, then there is a possible problem. In quantum field theory, you might have encountered this in the Carroll anomaly. Here, what's going on is that how do you regularize a measure in a path integral usually? How would you regularize the measure of a path integral? Say, I have a path integral for a scalar field, I want to regularize it. What do I do?
Compactify the space-time?
That's for infrared problems. I want to regularize UV problems.
You discretize,
that's right. Maybe you throw away all the modes whose frequency and wavelengths are too short. Right? These are all notions that use length as a notion. So it turns out it's perfectly possible to regularize this measure in a way that is diffeomorphism invariant, because lengths are a pretty diffeomorphic invariant notion. But they're not a well invariant notion. So it's very hard to regularize a measure in a way that remains well invariant after regularization. It's essentially impossible. So what you can do instead is you accept that the regularization breaks the symmetry, and then you try to see if you can restore it. So your measure, your regularized measure might change after you do a symmetry transformation, and you need to check if you can add some counter term to the action which will cancel this change. So you have anomalies when there are more things that can go wrong than things you can use to correct. So you really just write down the list of possible variations of the measure. And you write down the list of possible counterterms. And you check if they match or not. Typically, the difference between the two is a finite dimensional space. So there is a finite collection of things you need to check to make sure that the symmetry survives. For while symmetry in two dimensions is one number. There is just one possible thing that can go wrong and which cannot be corrected by a counterterm. This number is called the central charge. So when you look at the various ingredients of the measure, each of these ingredients will give some contribution to the central charge. The central charge vanishes, then the measure is well invariant, and this makes sense. the central charge does not vanish, then the measure is not well invariant, and this makes no sense. So the central charge is the denote C, little c. So it receives contribution from the scalar field from this axis, which is kind of the map from the surface into space-time. So each x contributes 1. So 1 times the number of x's, which is the dimension of space-time. The metric contributes minus 26. It's a painful calculation. The result is that the total central charge is d minus 26, which means that this theory, which is called bosonic string theory, can only make sense when the dimension of space-time is 26. When we repeat the calculation for superstrings, we'll find that the dimension of space-time should be 10. OK, any questions?
So do all the degenerate points of the Riemann surface, of the moduli space of the complex structure look like a Feynman diagram?
So all sort of the tubes, so the all sort of the asymptotic directions of the moduli space of complex structures do look like a Feynman diagram. That's right. Like a Feynman diagram where some lengths are becoming very long. So this is the statement, the only divergences you find in string perturbation theory are infrared divergences, which are very physical. They just tell you that you need to ask the correct question from a theory. So you don't get UV divergences, which correspond to short lengths. Any more questions? OK, so the next lecture is going to be just about this part, which means we study a free scalar, free massless scalar in two dimensions.